On Sunday, August 14th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will present Tony and Grammy Award winner Dee Dee Bridgewater. Tune in to hear more about this extraordinary song stylist, actress, and entertainer. That's Sunday, August 14th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Very quickly, before Dee Dee comes back, this is Sugar My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and Dee Dee Bridgewater is our guest. Stay tuned for Dee Dee Bridgewater and her daughter, manager, Tulani Bridgewater Kowalski, and a ticket giveaway. Thank you.
It's a thrill I still don't quite believe. But after you were gone, there was still some stardust on my sleeve. Forget to shine, and we may see the meadow in December. I see white and crystalline, but oh, my darling, always I'll remember when your lips were close to mine. I could see the midnight sun.
First interview together.
Oh,
that's true.
I get to hear how you talk when you do an interview.
Oh Lord,
I'm keeping this.
Yeah, I'm like, now the pressure's
on. Okay,
I was relaxed until 2 seconds ago.
Oh no. Whenever I do something with my children, Joyce, mm-hmm. I allow them to take the lead. Okay.
Okay. Hi, this is Joyce Jones from Sugar in My Bowl, and I'm here with
Dee Dee Bridgewater.
And Tulani Bridgewater Kowalski.
Thank you both for joining Sugar in My Bowl. One of the major reasons why we're on the phone right now is the upcoming release of Midnight Sun.
Yay! Yes, I love it.
And Midnight Sun is scheduled to release on August 23rd.
Right.
And it is also the fourth release on Dee Dee Bridgewater's label, your own label, DDB Records.
Correct.
Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
And the other three, just so people know, now you're going to help me with the 2005 release, the one
it is
front.
Called J'ai des amours.
And which is, I love that, though. The arrangements on there, oh my gosh, I just love it, love it.
Yay, thank you. And the musicians and I did the arrangements, so that was great. Totally organic.
And Red Earth is the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Red Earth, too.
Thank you.
It's just really just wonderful. And the Grammy winner.
Ta-ta-ta-ta. Eleanor Fagan.
Yes, 1915, 1959, To Billy with Love from Dee Dee.
Yeah.
Yay.
Uh-huh, exactly.
So, tell me about Midnight Sun. How did you decide, well, I guess Tulani.
Mm-hmm.
I understand you're the one that put these songs together.
Well, you know, we had a meeting with Universal, who distributes DDB Records, and they came to us and said, we want to do a back catalog release. And, of course, at first we thought they were joking. We said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, we want a compilation. We're like, but Dee Dee's alive.
Mm.
What do you mean? You know, we have this new album that just came out, and it was just before the Grammys, actually, that we were approached about it. And so they said, well, we have a proposal for you, and they sent over a track listing of songs that they'd selected in-house, and we thought, you know what, who knows her music better than us? We said, so we came back to them and we said, you know what, we have another idea. Why don't you let us put this together and we'll bring you a finished project if you'll just let us take the reins and run with it. And we were fortunate enough that the person who we work with primarily, named Wolf Mueller, was in full support, and he said, okay, sure, go ahead and do it. So Dee Dee has been lovingly harassed for years by her mother, my grandmother, about, why don't you do an album of pretty songs, of ballads? And so over the years, I'd kind of made her mixtapes for her listening pleasure, pulling some songs together just so that she would have a CD. And then
you mean for your grandmother?
For my grandmother.
Okay.
And she was very enamored of that. And then Dee Dee and China, my younger sister, who's also a recording artist, they put their heads together in person, and they started coming up with songs that they thought would be, you know, great for this project. And then Dee Dee and I got together and collaborated on the track listing and the vibe and feel that we wanted to have for the album. And she was on tour, so basically I spent a lot of time with my iPod and iTunes and kind of sorting through the songs and getting track listings together, and we were very much of the same mind. So I would come to her and say, well, what do you think about this one following this one? And then we'd come back and say, ah, you know, we don't like how that works. And so we finally got the songs together where we were happy with the flow and the general feeling of the project. And then Dee Dee said, okay, well, you've always wanted to produce an album, so here you go, produce it. Go,
wow.
Do. And I said, okay, you know. So that's what I did. So I was fortunate enough that we, you know, through Dee Dee's work, we have a wonderful relationship with Doug Sachs and with Sonny Nam up at the Mastering Lab. They're now up in Ojai. So I contacted Doug's office, and I worked with James, who's kind of their point person up there, and I had China running around France, and I had people at Universal in Germany and London digging up old masters, and I was pulling stuff out of storage, and
oh my.
Capitol Studios was rummaging around. Even our business manager was, like, digging around in their office because I was like, I need masters. So finally got everything up to the Mastering Lab. They remastered everything, got the sequencing set for us, shipped it out. I worked with the graphic designer that we've worked with on several projects, almost every project, actually, under DDB Records, a gentleman in France named Jean-Luc Barilla, and he and I collaborated, and I said, you know what, we've got a low budget for this thing, is the equivalent of nothing, and so we're going to use what we have. So it's kind of like the best of recycling possible. We used artwork that was pre-existing, and we kind of reworked it and pulled together all of the information on it, and so with a lot of teeth gnashing and hair pulling and fighting non-existent budgets but deadlines that were like yesterday, we managed to, you know, I pulled this together and delivered it, and everybody was like, oh, wow, why haven't we done this before? And I'm like, I don't know. Why haven't we done this before? But so we've been getting a tremendous response, and amazingly, it's being treated like a new release. So we're ecstatic about it. It's more than just a compilation. It's actually like a whole new album.
Well, one of them definitely wasn't on the U.S. release.
That's true. You know, every
yes.
time we do an album, we have to have a special bonus track just for Japan. So one of the tracks on this album has never been heard in the United States or anywhere else in the world for that matter. The other thing is that we were able to really restore the recordings, so the audio is better than, in some cases, on the original recordings, because we were able to remaster from the original master recordings as opposed to what had been proposed to us, which was just kind of to pull the finished product and kind of stick it together. So it's a beautiful sounding album, and some of this stuff is not easy to find anymore. So I think for Dee Dee's fans, it'll be really wonderful to have all of this in one place.
I understand everything is selected from Dear Ella, Keeping Tradition, This Is New, and Dee Dee.
Haters Amour.
And Love and Peace, a tribute to Horace Silver and the Eleonora Fagan.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's great breadth and scope, as they say. A little bit of everything.
Yeah. Excellent. So it will be available in your music purchasing places on August 23rd.
It will be available everywhere. We are launching worldwide everywhere on August 23rd. So we're having a release party, launch party, and then it's coming to your local retailer, online retailer, et cetera, later on this month. And buy it.
So, Talani, how did you wind up being a manager?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I've been trained for it. It's kind of like being born into a family of plumbers. You always know that you're going to work in plumbing in some capacity. But, you know, both of my parents are musicians. So there's Dee Dee and then my father, Cecil Bridgewater, who's a trumpet player and has performed with many of the industry greats, like Max Roach, he performed with for many years, and then Loud Minority and several others, and he's also an educator. So
that would be Frank Foster's Loud Minority.
Yes, Frank Foster, who recently passed away, unfortunately. So, you know, with the two of them, I always was around music. And then I think that when you have parents who are touring, and, you know, and I grew up with Dee Dee, because my parents divorced, you know, I got to spend my summers on the road with her. And, you know, no one gets a free ticket. So I hauled luggage. I collected money from promoters. I haggled about meals. I got hotel rooms changed. I got into, you know, arguments with other musicians and tour managers. And
made
know,
me shut up.
And made her sit down in the corner. So I think it just kind of came naturally. And then, you know, I worked at a record label while I was in college, worked at Island Records. And when I graduated, I came out to L.A. and got a job working with Ken Fritz, who was handling George Benson at the time. And so I came on, and the first person I worked for was George Benson. And it kind of just swept onward from there. So I've been doing this for forever.
Wow.
Literally forever. And I love it. But it's a privilege to work with my mother. It's a great gift.
So how does it feel for you, Dee Dee, to work with your daughter? As you
mentioned? Oh, I love it. I trust no one more in the world than my children and my firstborn, which is Talani. And I have a very special bond, and I absolutely love it. I don't have to worry about anything. I know that she's got my back. She's an excellent, excellent diplomat, where I can be harsh. She's extremely intelligent and a very gifted woman. So I love working with my daughter. At first I was hesitant. I thought that, you know, when Talani suggested working together, I was actually looking for management, and I couldn't find anyone that I felt comfortable enough with to just relinquish my life over to them. And I just thought, when she suggested, I said, oh, this is the way to ruin a mother-daughter relationship. This will never work. And here we are in our 12th year.
Wow.
Our 12th year together.
Yeah.
And we've grown together, you know, in terms of our industry savvy, and Talani is leaps and bounds ahead of me in terms of anything having to do with the internet and the use of it. All I know how to do is send an email, and I don't do that well because I don't read my email. So, yeah, I'm an old dinosaur, and she's a young chick, and so I let her run.
Excellent.
And it's beautiful. It's nice, except sometimes I have to say, I fear that the career can overshadow the actual mother-daughter relationship, and I worry that our working together can be a kind of subtle problem for Talani's personal life and her family life and her married life. But for the moment, it's all working, so we're not changing anything.
Excellent.
I'm still married.
She's still married, and now she has two beautiful children, and we just celebrated my grandson's 5th birthday yesterday.
Oh, yay.
Yeah, and then Thursday is also Talani's birthday.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time this airs, you will have celebrated your...
Yes, I will be turning 5 as well.
Yes.
I like that. See, she's very good.
Yes.
Very good. That was very good, wasn't it?
It was excellent. So what song, now, when I've opened the program, I will have already played Midnight Sun, which I love.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful arrangement.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah, yeah. John Clayton did a great job on it.
Which other song would you suggest I play?
Oh. Ooh, they're all wonderful. Talani, let this be your choice, my love. You produce.
Shall we play The Island?
Ooh.
Love it.
If we're up at night.
Oh, yeah. Let's. I was going to say that, Talani.
See? Great minds.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least mine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Talani.
Thank you so much.
Talani Bridgewater Kowalski.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Speaking
now,
of...
Now, what else do you want to talk about?
Lots of stuff. Well, speaking of projects, the Mosaic Project with...
Terry Lynn's project.
Yeah.
That's pretty hip, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness, it's fabulous.
Yeah.
I'm so digging that. I mean, it's, every emotion is stirred listening to that one. And you perform Soul Talk.
Yeah, gosh, please.
were playing. To your soul.
Had to do and say. segments, and she had to count me in because she put all these crazy time signatures all over that song. And I was like, you know, Carrie Lynn, but this is just especially for you. I said, I can't count anymore. I don't know. You know, it was like trying to play double dutch. And you haven't played it.
Yes.
And, you know, when do you go in? When is that? Oh, God. So now she's organizing a concert for the Mosaic Project. She and Nona Hendrix are working on it together.
Actually,
and,
Nona Hendrix co-wrote Soul Talk.
Yeah, so, you know, there's the possibility I'll have to sing it live. Oh,
wow.
It scares me.
Yeah, I can understand that. I
yeah.
was listening to it while I was on my exercise bike.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to get a rhythm going. It's like, oh, my gosh, this
no,
is amazing.
Impossible. No, it's impossible. Then she told me that because we went in and I did the vocal on a partially recorded track. And then she went back and recorded all the live instruments. And she says, well, you know, the musicians, they had a difficult time with it, too. I said, okay, thank you.
Hmm.
It's a thing that drummers do.
I was just going to say, because she's the drummer and she's running the song.
Yeah.
So she's having a great time.
Oh, yeah. She's loving it. And she's got a mathematical mind, and I don't. It's all good. It's a lovely song, but it's just a beautiful project. And with all the women, it's just beautiful. And it seems like we're in a women's cycle in music. Don't you think?
I was thinking that as I was listening to it.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, well, there are a lot of vocalists out, whether they be jazz or jazz-tinged, mm-hmm. that are really in the limelight now, and a lot of female musicians are getting their propers now,
yeah.
and it's just it's a beautiful moment in that respect,
mm-hmm.
and especially if you juxtapose it against, you know, what's going on economically and globally. It just makes for a wonderful, wonderful moment. So I'm very happy to be a part of Carrie Lynn's project. And she is a woman that I admire greatly and that I love even more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She and Nona Hendrix, because they seem to be working together on that one.
Yeah.
A lot of that project.
Yeah.
But TLC.
The TLC is the bomb.
Yes.
You know, we all kind of fight over who's going to be playing with her, you know. Is it going to be Espy? You know, Esperanza Spalding, or if it's going to be Diane, or if it's going to be me. And come on, Diane, give me a break now. I want to go with Carrie Lynn, and, you know, it's great.
So you were born Denise Garrett.
Yes. Must we? Yes.
Denise.
Denise Eileen. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Were you named after someone?
Irish. Well, Denise is French, and yes, I was named after a French actress from the late 40s named Denise Darcel. And Eileen is my paternal grandmother's, well, was, I should say. My grandma died.
And you were born in Memphis.
I was.
Tennessee.
And I was just speaking with Talani about going to Memphis. I've never been. Well, I was back last year. It was the first time I ever went back, and it was for a concert. So I literally flew in, day of show, did the show, flew out the next morning. So I can't tell you what Memphis looks like. So I would like to go back and, you know, just to try and close the gap on understanding my past. And after having done Red Earth, you know, and trying to find and embrace my African ancestry, I think I should also now move forward and try and understand my past, you know, growing up here in the United States and starting out in Memphis, Tennessee before moving north to Michigan, where I grew up in Flint.
Flint, Michigan.
My mother was born in Flint, and that's how we moved back there. And Flint was the hub for General Motors when I was a little girl, and so there was a lot of movement from the South for African Americans because there was a lot of job opportunities. You know, the factories were there. So many people that grew up in Flint, Michigan were from Alabama, Mississippi, you know,
mm-hmm.
Missouri, Arkansas. You know, there was that whole northern movement, you know. So I need to understand my southern roots and just try to paint a full picture of who I am and why I am the way I am and have the taste that I do. And so I'm going to try to go to Memphis, and who knows, maybe a blues album will come out of it.
Oh, that would be nice. interesting you should say that a blues album, because in listening to Red Earth, that sounded like a blues album to
me. It is a blues album.
Yeah.
It is, because, well, you know, Malian music, West African music, and in particular Malian music, really is very connected to African-American blues and jazz.
Right.
And I figured that out, you know, from going to Mali. And in doing that Red Earth Malian project, I realized, you know, that our music is just, as Sheikh Tidian Sekou actually really helped me to put the Red Earth project together. He's from Mali, and he was my guide and introduced me to all of the musicians that performed on the album. 47 Malian musicians were on that project.
Wow.
As he likes to say, he says jazz and blues are just a branch on the Malian tree of music.
Mm.
And I really believe it, because you can hear, like you said, in the Red Earth Project, you can hear the blues. And in blending the two traditional sounds together of the Malian griot music and then tradition of jazz and blues, it's clear as day to me.
Right.
It becomes very clear that we're totally related. But we're all related anyway. We just don't like to think that.
So in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
you wound up attending Michigan State University.
Yeah, but only for 1 year.
Okay.
It doesn't really count. You know, I went there because my mother was bugging me about going to college. I actually had wanted to take a year sabbatical, but she said if I took a year sabbatical, I'd never go to college.
Mm.
And I had a lot of scholarship offers because I was a pretty good student all the way through school, honor roll student and, you know, A student. But I was bored with school. And so when I went to Michigan State University, I basically partied. I did. I was an English major.
Okay.
And at the end of my first year, my English professor stole all my writing.
What?
Yeah. And two other students and quit the school.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was so disheartened because I'd written a lot of poetry. I'd written several short stories, and I was so disgusted that I just said, forget it. And I did some collegiate jazz competitions and won several of them. And one of the ones that I won, the prize was to go to the University of Illinois and perform at a collegiate festival they were having. And so after my performance, I was approached by the head of the jazz department at the University of Illinois to see if I'd like to do a State Department tour of Russia. And so I transferred my 3 credits to the University of Illinois and enrolled in school for a semester so that I could do a State Department tour going to Russia. And that's what I did. And after that, I promptly dropped out of school and married my first husband. I met him at the University of Illinois where he was working on his doctorate.
Did he finish?
He finished.
Okay.
Well, I could always sing, and I was able to subsidize my college life by singing in lounges and hotels. On college campuses, you have a lot of little restaurants that will have live music for the students, and that's what I did. And then it ended up that I was working 7 nights a week, and I was making good money, and
wow.
I was able to look cute, and you know, and then I was like, shoot. Let me just do this. And then I married Cecil. I was 2 weeks into being 20 years old when I got married.
What was your musical relationship like?
It was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
He did all of my arranging. That was nice.
Mm.
In-house. I didn't have to pay anybody. And now I pay him.
So you still work together?
Well, I asked Cecil, you know, I thought that we should bury the hatchet because ours was a rather contentious divorce. And I thought for the sake of Talani that it would be good to bury the hatchet so that Talani could get on with her life instead of feeling like she had something to do with the breakup, which children ultimately do.
Right. Feel like it.
When they're young, especially.
Right.
And you're not able to really explain to them in a way that they can understand. So I hired him to do some arranging for me for the Dear Ella album.
Well, you did Dear Ella before you did Red Earth?
That was way before.
Yeah.
That was in 97.
Right, right. And you won a Grammy for that one.
I won, well, actually the album won 2 Grammys.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
One for best jazz vocal.
Best, and best arrangement accompanying
a vocal.
Vocal.
Yes.
Or Cottontail. Or Slide Hampton's arrangement of Cottontail.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. Dee Dee Bridgewater is my guest for the evening. She is the spotlight. She is the focus. And there will be a ticket giveaway, but not right now. It's for the people who can hang out with me a little longer. And as a matter of fact, if you're missing any information list-wise, give me a call at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. I'm going to talk all over this arrangement. But you could also email me at sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. And stay tuned.
In so doing, we had to start conversing, and then I told him, you know, we're harming our daughter, and we need to move forward, and you need to come back into her life as a father, and you need to apologize to her for not being a good father to her, and let's move on. So that's what eventually happened, and it was a beautiful moment, because I'm all about trying to go full circle in relationships and in life in general, because I don't want to leave this earth regretting that I didn't resolve anything. So I don't want that in my life. I don't want it with any of my marital relationships, with my friendships, business relationships. I think it's always good to be clear, and so that both parties can walk away from something feeling some degree of satisfaction and that, you know, there's an understanding.
It's a very evolved way of being.
Well,
wonderful.
It took many years.
Of course.
You know, I think I can say this at 61.
Oh, beautiful.
You know?
Well, there's one satisfying relationship that I'm certain you still look back at and smile a lot. Your relationship with Thad Jones and Lewis.
Thad Jones especially. I was Thad's girl. I loved Thad Jones.
Mm.
And I like to say that my music school was performing with the Thad Jones, my Lewis big band.
Right.
And everything that I really learned as a professional jazz singer, I learned from Thad Jones. He was my mentor.
Well, that's something that seems to be, and I notice I have this conversation with musicians frequently with regard to the lack of that opportunity being available these days.
You know, it's very true. I don't understand what that is. I don't understand why musicians don't feel they need to help foster relationships between the up-and-coming musicians and themselves. I think that it has to do with insecurities. I believe that the music industry has had a lot of play in that, and I say that because jazz saw a kind of golden era in the 90s when the major record labels discovered that jazz was marketable and money could be made if they invested in the artist and did just the slightest bit of marketing
mm-hmm.
on these artists. And so that was the period when we had the Young Lions.
Right.
And
I believe that generation of musicians, those musicians were in like their 30s and maybe early 40s, and they'd been waiting and waiting to have their turn, and then they got it, and then musicians were pitted against each other by the labels, and then it kind of fostered this protectionist attitude that a lot of musicians developed, and singers, you know, because everyone was trying to protect their position and their standing in that particular setting.
Just so people have an idea of that period in the 90s, would that be, say, Wynton Marsalis, Kenny Kirkland?
Yeah, Roy Hargrove.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the musicians that happened during that period in the 90s, you know, they were riding high, and then one day, all the majors decided, enough of that.
Right.
And then they just disposed of everybody. And there were very few that were left with a label deal. And, I mean, literally, they just kind of tossed people out on their tushes.
Right.
And, you know, they built them up and, you know, and inflated their egos, and then they said, okay, we don't need you anymore. You've served us. You're disposable. Let's throw you away. And then that was when this new turn came, where it took us into the 21st century, and the record labels were able to start amassing talent that was non-African American, which has always been the main representation of the music, jazz, and finding non-African American counterparts that they didn't put lots of money into building careers, and we're able to, like, switch the focus. Unfortunately, given the history of the United States, I wasn't surprised.
Right.
But for a lot of people, it was a very rude awakening. So I think it fostered bitterness and then, you know, fear that these people aren't going to be able to get new recording contracts. So why are they going to work with somebody younger who can steal the thunder, steal the limelight, and can go on and get what they don't have? Not understanding that by supporting the youth, we're helping to prolong the music.
Exactly.
Keep it going.
Continue the legacy.
Exactly. So one of the things that I am trying to do, since I have, I would call it a vanity label. It's not a full-fledged label such as Branford Marsalis has. I couldn't do that. I didn't want to do that headache. But this label is more like a vanity label. I have a license agreement with Universal. That means it's a distribution deal. I produce all of my records, which I've been doing since 1993, but now that they allowed me to establish DDB Records, part of my licensing deal is that I can produce other artists. They will advance me monies if should I require it to produce an artist, and if they agree, then they will provide me with the distribution. If they are not in agreement, then I have to find separate distribution for that artist, but under the DDB label.
Interesting.
But what I've done is, because I'm at the end of my present contract, I didn't want to have a production that I was about to do fall in the cracks of one deal and maybe not make it into the next deal. So I've just finished producing my first artist using my own funds.
And who is that?
It's a young trumpet player named Theo Croker, and he's the grandson of Doc Cheatham.
Trumpeter. Wow, okay.
Mm-hmm. And he's wonderful. He's just a very versatile, extremely talented young man, writes great compositions, really has an affinity for singers. He's got five vocal tracks on the CD. I really didn't want it, but...
So another trumpeter, huh?
I have an affinity for trumpet
players. Yes. My
father was a trumpet player.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a little girl, he was playing. He put the trumpet down as I got into my late teens. My heroes are, you know, Miles Davis, Thad Jones, Art Terry. I love Lee Morgan, Freddie Hubbard.
I was just going to ask you about Freddie Hubbard.
Oh, love Freddie Hubbard. You know, it was all these trumpet players. I don't know. Maybe it's a Freudian thing.
Or maybe it's just a thing. People tend to connect towards certain instrumentations, so.
Yeah, and I think of my voice as a trumpet.
Right. Well, there you have it.
When I'm performing, I think of my voice as the other horn in my band. And I don't know, if people pay attention to the voice in concert, you know, I'll change up the sound that I have depending on the songs that I'm doing and what the emotion is that I'm trying to get across. I'll change up the whole texture of my voice to go with that moment, much like a musician would do.
Now, I want to go back to a time which I tend to think of as a musical exploration for you. This was in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I was reading some writings recently about you during that period, and, you know, the way they phrased it, it was like, oh, she wasn't sure where she wanted to go. I was like, you know, that was a ripe time for me, I thought, for you.
Well, the thing was, I was working with the best big band at the time when I landed my job with the Thad Jones St. Louis Orchestra.
Right.
And because of that, I toured all over the world with the Thad Jones St. Louis Orchestra. And I played in some of the biggest concert halls. And mind you, I was between the ages of 20 and 24.
Wow.
And we don't really know what we're doing at that age.
Right.
Okay, we're ready to do whatever.
Uh-huh.
All I know is that I love to sing. And I didn't see why my singing needed to be limited to just jazz.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up on R&B and Motown.
Right.
And I had jazz in the house.
Right.
So I was always a little schizophrenic. When I would go in my room and shut the door at home, I turned on my local R&B station and could sing every song that played.
Right.
I also grew up when Motown Records started in Detroit in 1962. Everybody in Flint, Michigan that sang or played wanted to be signed to Motown.
Right.
The Marvelettes, one of the first Motown groups, is from Flint, Michigan.
Hmm.
And two of the girls live one street over from me.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, maybe I've got split personality, but I grew up listening to Nancy Wilson and and Ramsey Lewis and then Cannonball Adderley and Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie, and then I would sneak out the house to go see the Temptations and the Four Tops and the Miracles and Smokey Robinson. And, you know, hello.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are two things here. There's the fact that radio was different, it seemed, then. Radio played different types. It wasn't as limited to what it's limited to today.
No.
And what those different voices and styles and what have you have definitely made you a better singer.
Well, I'd like to think I am a singer.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I loved RiRi. I still love Aretha.
She was on the Capitol label in the beginning.
And that's where I wanted to be.
Oh.
I had an audition with Motown Records when I was 16.
What?
And Berry Gordy came to personally hear me and told my father to bring me back when I was 18. And he was going to sign me to a contract because they were having, you know, child labor problems with Stevie Wonder.
Mm.
And he didn't want to sign any more underage children. I mean, it caused quite a furor when I was singing, and people were coming out of their studios to hear me sing.
Oh,
and,
my.
And, you know, I was told that I sounded like a young Mary Wells.
Huh.
No, no, no. And I remember, you know, driving back from that audition for Motown, and it was my father that had arranged it through the famous drummer that did all the session work, Pistol. Driving back, I said, you know what, Daddy? I don't want to sign with Motown. Like, I know what I'm talking about. I want to sign with Capitol.
Oh, my goodness.
That's where Nancy Wilson is. I want to sign with Capitol.
I see.
That never happened. And I never went back. I never went back to Detroit.
Hmm. Well, there's one recording that I thought, one of your first recordings, when you were with Stanley Clarke.
Oh, Children Up Forever.
Exactly, with Andy Bay.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll sail through the day, make love through the night, on a bed of the emerald tide. Come with me. As we go on our journey, lifetime.
Love with me. Please, life with me. You're something that no one does. Come. this is Alec Baldwin, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Anything can happen. Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York. Anything can happen.
We'll drift into forevermore.
Great album.
It's just wonderful.
Yeah, Sea Journey, Unexpected Days.
Sea Journey is...
Building up forever. Yeah. Yeah.
Love it. Sea Journey. I love that one. That's Chick Corea's Sea Journey.
That's right.
Have you ever sang with Andy Bay since then? Or
No.
Okay. Are you going to revisit that at some point or no?
Well, it hadn't been in the forefront of my mind.
Hmm.
And, goodness, I haven't seen Andy for years, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I never thought about it. So you put that thought in my brain.
Yay, because I would love to hear you.
I hear you. Loud and clear.
Excellent.
I hadn't thought about that at all. Thank you.
Norman Connors, how'd you wind up doing Dark of Light?
Dark of Light?
Girl. I'm digging in the crates.
You are. He asked.
Oh.
He asked me if I'd be a part of the project. Oh, my Lord.
Had he seen you perform somewhere?
I guess he had.
Okay.
I have to wrap my brain around Dark of Light. Oh, yeah, I sang on Butterfly Dream.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I sang on those two.
Okay.
With... another singer named Ellen DeLestis.
Mm.
On a new project and would like me to be a part of it.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. Great album.
It's not easy to find these days.
No, it's not.
So then, your first solo release, Afro Blue, which is another hard to find.
Joy.
Trash man didn't get my trash today. Oh, why? Because they want more pay. Buses and taxis want a raise in fare, so they can help pollute the air. But that's what makes the world go round. The ups and downs, a carousel, changing people's heads around, go underground, young men. People make the world go round. Street losing now on every ship. they're blaming it on longer hair. Big men smoking in their easy chairs on fat cigars without a care.
And you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. I do not know why this is doing what it's doing. This disc is acting up. So let's listen to a little Children of Forever, and hopefully everything will make its way perfect soon. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in my bowl. Stay tuned. Children. Children of Forever. Stay tuned.
An album that I recorded in Tokyo, Japan,
mm-hmm.
While on tour with the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra. I was approached by a gentleman that said he wanted to do an album and for a small label in Japan, and I allowed my first husband to negotiate the deal. Horrible deal. I told him, you'll never negotiate anything else for me, baby. But horrible deal.
And basically, we just gave him everything.
Mm.
We went into the studio after a concert. And literally, Roland Hanna, who was the pianist and the Sir Roland Hanna, as
mm-hmm.
he was knighted.
Yes.
And Cecil and Ronnie, you know, and I put together the songs. And Ron Bridgewater, Cecil's brother, did some of the songs. And Cecil, you know, arranged some of the songs. And
mm-hmm.
and then some were just, we just kind of did them, you know, on the spur of the moment.
Wow.
While we were in the studio. But we recorded everything in, I believe it was one night.
Wow.
I think so, because that's the way you did jazz back then,
well,
in
yeah.
those days. And it was a wonderful project. And it received a lot of accolades, you know, in Japan.
So I guess that explains why we may have a difficult time ever seeing it printed here.
Yeah, it had a re-release in the early 90s on some strange label.
Mm. Frank Foster's Loud Minority?
Oh, Frank.
Who recently transitioned.
I know, yeah. I know.
Tell me about that poem you read on Loud Minority.
It was a poem that Frank wrote.
Oh, okay.
We are part of the loud minority, mm. and as such, we... I can't remember.
You've just given me the best segue.
The loud minority. We are a part of the loud minority, and as such, we are a part of those concerned with change. This change must come in the form of victory over all the evils. The loud minority is not a non-profit organization, for indeed our profit must be the result of that victory. We are a part of the loud minority, and as such, we are a part of those concerned with freedom.
Freedom! Freedom!
Over our own destiny, our own mind, our own family. The freedom comes only with the change, and the change comes only with the victory, so the victory is mandatory. We are a part of the loud minority as opposed to you know who.
Like in the early 70s, I guess you could say that I was, you know, like hot property. I
mm-hmm.
didn't realize it because I was so busy, you know, just trying to live and raise Talani, because by the time I was 22, I'd had Talani and mm-hmm. being married to a musician and, you know, trying to have some sort of stability in the house. I wasn't too concerned about things going on around me.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying there was all of that activism going on and you couldn't really focus on it?
Well, I was involved. I was pretty active. I was involved with the Black Panthers.
Oh.
I was at Michigan State University. And
okay.
I kept up with them and worked with the local Panther headquarters
mm-hmm.
based out of Brooklyn, New York. And I printed up pamphlets, distributed them in the streets for meetings.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. No, I was very much into Black is Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
and wearing African clothes and my hair natural until I shaved it off when I met this beautiful sister in 74. And one day I'm walking down the street in a little coastal city in France, a little town called Le Touquet. Do you know who I cross on the street? I was like, I must be hallucinating.
Who's that?
Elaine Brown.
Oh, well, that could happen. She hangs out in France.
Yeah, well, I didn't know she hung out in France.
Oh.
What were the chances that I would cross her in Le Touquet? And then she went past, and I was like, that's Elaine Brown. And I turned around and said, Elaine Brown? Yes. Who's asking? Just the two of us on the street. I was like, okay. No, it was just, I recognized you from the Panther days. Peace. She went on her way.
Okay.
It wasn't accessible.
Okay. Oh,
she didn't want to talk. But yeah, I did the breakfast program. They had started a wonderful breakfast program.
That is true. I and my siblings, we enjoyed the breakfast program. We got a lot from it.
Oh, how wonderful. I was doing that when I was at Michigan State.
Oh, okay.
I worked with the Panther Party and out of East Lansing and went and distributed food at the schools before school. And I loved the Panthers. It was a great organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the newsletters were incredible.
Yes.
And very informative.
Right.
About our rights and, you know, and just knowing basic laws, you know.
Right.
So anything I know about, you know, social justice and law, I learned from reading the Black Panther newsletters.
So you then recorded with Roy Ayers. Well, there are two recordings that you did, Tear to a Smile.
Tear to a Smile.
And Lifeline.
And also, I did the title track for the movie Coffee. Coffee, baby.
Oh.
Sweet as a candy bar. Yeah.
Okay.
Coffee, baby. Sweet as a chocolate bar.
I worked with him in concert. I did a tour with him. Oh, I did two tours with him. The second tour, he fired me, though.
Oh.
I was pregnant with my second daughter, China, and that was in 1978.
Oh.
And
would that be the Just Family baby?
That's the Just Family baby.
Shine so bright, a cold desire to grow. You
And you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. This is Children of the Spirit from Just Family. There's a reference there to China Moses, Dee Dee Bridgewater's second daughter. I'm not going to continue, but if you need to reach me, you can give me a call at 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. I'll help you with this playlist. Or you can email me at sugarinmybowl@gmail.com. Sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl at gmail.com. Or you can go to our website under construction, sugarinmybowl.org, sugarinmybowl.org.
I could protect you, child, from the dues you have to pay, from racist things and ugly things that might get in your way. When your imagination's right and your ego to play, and you're doing all you can and no one stops to say, children, be the spirit of the world.
That's right. She's my Just Family baby. Her name is China.
Okay.
Yeah. She's a singer now and MTV VJ in France.
Oh, okay.
Getting ready to start a new career as a journalist for a primetime news show in France.
That's right.
For Canal Plus.
She's busy.
Critiquing music and films and books. Had some wonderful moments with Roy. Yeah, but he fired me. He said I was stealing the show. I said, well, maybe it's a baby. He's like, you gotta go. I was like, Roy. He says, I gotta fire you. I was like, Roy. But I love him dearly. And I recorded a duet with him, I think it was like 3 years ago, but I don't know. I never saw the light of day.
Oh, was it on his recording?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I've asked him about it. He's like, you know, Dee Dee. I was like, okay, fine, Roy. Okay, whatever. He's a hoot. Fabulous. What a wonderful man. And the energy.
Uh-huh.
His energy is contagious. When you talk to him, he sounds like he's like 12 years old. I'm like, hey, Roy, it's Dee Dee Bridgewater. Dee Dee Bridgewater. Oh, this isn't Dee Dee Bridgewater. Dee Dee Bridgewater. I'm talking to Dee Dee Bridgewater. I said, boy, come on. Yeah, I love him.
If you believe within your heart, you'll know that no one can change the path that you must go. Believe what you feel and know you're right, because the time will come around when you'll say it's yours. Thank you.
The Wiz.
Oh, girl, what are you doing? Are we, this is like a complete stroll down memory lane.
Well.
The Wiz.
The
How
Wiz.
Fabulous was The Wiz.
Now, you had never acted, apparently, but you were a performer, so I guess that helped you.
Well, I had a wonderful director, the man who became my second husband, Gilbert Moses. And he taught me a lot about being on the stage. And, you know, but well, by the time we got to Broadway, my role had been reduced to 5 lines. But I had a pretty, pretty nice role when we were doing tryouts, something of the past also. Back in those days, in the 70s, when a musical was mounted, they did what they called tryout, where they would go to all of these big cities outside of New York before they go to Broadway, and they'd work out any kinks in the show. And so by the time that you came in to do the show on Broadway, things were pretty cool. But The Wiz had such a tumultuous history and story. And yeah, but
there needs to be a book.
Yeah. There could be a book just about The Wiz.
Right.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lord. Things that went on. But on that show, that's where I left Cecil and hooked up with Gilbert, the father of my daughter, China.
Wonderful.
Just family baby.
And you won a Tony.
I did, for 5 lines of dialogue and a half a song. My take was like, oh, this is, you know, sweet revenge for everything that the producers had tried to do to Gilbert and did to Gilbert and then turned on me because I was with Gilbert. And
wow.
Then they tried to fire me, and Jeffrey Holder had taken over when they fired Gilbert. And he says, no, Glinda must stay. Bridgewater must stay. You know how Jeffrey Holder speaks.
Yes.
No, darling, this is the cola nut.
Seven-Up commercials. Oh, my God.
The cola nut. I like how he says cola.
Yes.
And the lips, cola. I love that. What a fabulous couple, he and Carmen.
Yes. After winning the Tony, in spite of everything that happened and you won the Tony, you then had a recording contract with Atlantic, yes?
Yes. That was one of the wonderful things that happened out of winning the Tony Award. I started to get all these recording contract offers, and so I chose Atlantic because Aretha was there.
Yeah, that's what I suspected.
You know, I have to have a point of reference.
Sure.
You know, I had Mercury Records was really, really, really knocking on the door hard, but I finally said, no, I want to be in Atlantic with Aretha. I want to be on Capitol with Nancy. I want to be in Atlantic with Aretha. It made sense to me.
Of course.
And I got to work with Jerry Wexler, who had produced about all of Aretha's Atlantic recordings.
And Gene Page on your first recording.
Oh, I got to work with Gene Page.
He had such amazing arrangements.
Oh, didn't he?
Oh, my goodness.
But the album that I did, that album is still in the can.
Yes.
At Atlantic. Because when that album was about to be released, Jerry Wexler turned in the album, and then he said, I quit.
Oh!
It's like, here's the album, and I quit. Yes. So then they sent me back into the studio with the producers of the Wiz cast album, Harold Wheeler and Steve Schaefer.
Okay.
So that's the album that came out with, I think, just two of the original tracks I'd recorded on it.
So that's the one that has My Prayer?
Mm-hmm. The slow version and the fast version.
Right, yeah, the disco version.
When the twilight is gone and no songbird is singing, when the twilight is gone, you come into my to linger with you at the end of
Queen.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It was Grace Jones, and after Grace, it was Dee Dee Bridgewater.
That's right.
Yeah. I did all the hot discotheques across the country now.
Yes. And you had Bad For Me.
Bad For Me.
That is like the club song.
Yeah, Bad For Me.
Frankie Knuckles?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Frankie. And I think that's like the definitive club version.
Mm.
That was a great period. I love the early disco period.
Yes.
Are you kidding? That was fabulous. Oh, there were all these great discos in New York. Oh, my Lord. And I was a regular at Studio 54. Oh, yeah. Loved it.
You know, somewhere in between Lifeline and Bad For Me, you did Modern Man with Stanley Clark.
I did?
Yes, you did. It was actually one that he sang on.
He did?
Yes, he did.
What did I sing?
Actually, see, that was the thing. It was one of those recordings where you didn't solo. You did the sort of...
vocalese.
Yes, yes.
That's why it doesn't stick out in my
mind.
Right. And then School Days.
Right.
I did some kind of vocalese. Now Stanley's so huge, you know, when I see him, he's like, oh, hello, Dee Dee. What's because he's so tall? Hello, Dee Dee. Like, hello, Stanley. You know, and then he moves on.
Oh, no. Well, I was going to ask you, what was it like, you know, working with him?
Oh, it was wonderful because, yeah. we were part of, you know, the Young Little Starlets.
Yeah.
You know, and we had similar musical tastes. We both were frustrated rock artists. You know,
right.
He pursued his, but I couldn't.
Mm.
You know, because when I went to Electra and said, I want to do a rock album, they were like, excuse me, you are black, you don't do rock.
Okay. Mm.
You know, so I got caught in that. But Sammy being a musician, he could go in and work with Keith Richards and do all the rock stuff that he did. So.
Well, he was doing the, you know, of course, with Chick, they had the sort of rock jazz thing going on.
Mm-hmm. Already.
Yeah, yeah, so he could do that.
Yeah, but...
And then
he
went funky. Ian George.
He did well.
Duke.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was all, you know, that was my crowd.
Mm.
You know, so working with Stanley was like working with a good friend.
Oh, good.
We were good friends at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they came over to our house in L.A., and Gilbert and I would go over to theirs, and Talani and Christopher, their son, would play together. And mm-hmm. No. It was still part of that period when everyone shared everything. Okay. And you would go to a concert, and and it was wonderful to go to live concerts because you never knew who was going to sit in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because there was a lot of that going on. It was just a wonderful, wonderful period that I was able to grow up in the 70s. There was a lot of nurturing. We had our little collectives, and everybody worked together on each other's projects, and it was just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get a call in the morning and go be in the studio in the afternoon.
Now, were you living in New York?
I was living in New York in the early 70s.
Okay.
I moved to L.A. in 76 with The Wiz to open the L.A. company.
Yeah, I'm getting out of the 70s and going to Brother from Another Planet.
Oh, my Lord, girl.
Malvern Davis.
Oh, my Lord. You were good in bed last night, but you have got to do something about them ponies.
Yes.
What can I say? I can say I was in a John Sayles movie.
How did you wind up doing that?
I
did you audition?
Oh,
okay.
And was hired.
Wow. And you sang Getaway.
I was like, how am I singing this song? I'm up in Harlem. Okay. Whatever.
Sisters, get away straight from the heart. Get away straight from the sun. Get away straight from the city. Hey, hey, hey.
You gonna sit on that all night? Very funny. Look, can I get you another drink? I don't care, but the boss has been on my ass all night. Good. But did you know?
Listen, I'm going to sit here for a minute, but don't get any ideas, all right? The man that owns this club has been on my ass since I opened here, and I'm trying to keep him off of it. So if he comes by, you are my gentleman friend from Philadelphia, okay?
That was another thing, because John Sayles is part of this whole artistic community in Hoboken.
Oh, okay.
New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And so his wife was one of the producers, along with a good friend of theirs, so these two women produced the movie, and and another friend, you know, did the music, that music. And, you know, it was low budget.
Yes,
and who knew it was going to become this kind of cult hit?
Right, right.
So that's fun.
It's really a sweet movie.
It really is. It is, yes. Malvern Davis. And about 6 months ago, I found the press pictures from the movie.
Oh,
and
wow.
The photo that they used in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
For the album cover
and the poster.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
everything
yeah.
else.
Yeah. I just found those pictures. I was like, oh, the feathered hair we used to have. I didn't know this was going to be a walk down memory lane.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. This is what Sugar in My Bowl is. That's what we do here.
I didn't know that about this show. I like Sugar in My Bowl. Honey in my tea. Coffee in my cup. That's a great title for a show.
Yeah, a friend of mine came up with it. So, around 1986, we've left New York. You've gone to France.
Oh, that's true.
That's how I've read it anyway.
That's good.
So, tell us about Simone
Ginevra.
Yes.
Simone Ginevra was a partner of George Wein. You are in the world of jazz, the famous producer of the JVC Jazz Festival, the Newport Jazz Festival.
Yes.
And he started some festivals in Europe and in France. The festival that he started was the Nice Jazz Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Simone Ginevra when George Wein decided that he wanted Simone to book me for the Nice Jazz Festival in 86. And she became my mentor. She really is responsible for my music career starting off after I finished doing The Fiscated Ladies, and I decided, this was in 84, I'm sorry, my chronological
order. Okay, I said 86, so.
But that's the first time that I met her, was in 84. And when I came back in 86, then she helped me to set up doing my concerts and told me to steer away from doing any of the little jazz clubs where singers performed so that I wouldn't get on the local circuit. She said if I wanted to have a real career in France and not just a Parisian career, that I had to steer clear of these little traps, that she called them, for Americans that came to France wanting to have a career. I found some work kind of underground and to make money. And I was singing in the restaurant there called Le Privilège, and which was like the spot where all the who's who of French society and, you know, Americans coming over, celebrities coming over, they would all hang out at Le Privilège and then go upstairs and dance and get drunk. And I was a singer every night, just myself. And a pianist. And I had a different pianist, and I did that 7 nights a week until Simone had gigs for me.
Now, how did you wind up doing Lady Day? Did you get that through...
I got that through the woman that produced me in it, a woman named Ellen Memran. I was performing at the Hotel Meridien there, which has a beautiful area that they've dedicated to Lionel Hampton called the Lionel Hampton Room. And I would do like multiple week runs in there when I wasn't doing concerts. And this woman came to see me performing there because I was starting to get a nice following just at the Hotel Meridien. And proposed me doing the play Lady Day in French.
So Eleanor Fagan wasn't your first encounter?
No, no. And Eleanor Fagan, the repertoire on the CD is taken from the repertoire of the songs that I sang in this play with music. They call it a musical, but it was like a one-woman show with a lot of dialogue, a lot of dialogue. And
you were nominated for...
The Laurence Olivier Award for Best Actress in a Musical.
Now, that's the equivalent of a Tony?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But for me, more prestigious because, you know, theater started in England. You know, so to get a nomination in British theater, I thought was pretty huge.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it was a beautiful play, a very difficult play for me to do because I had to really deal with a lot of my own personal demons as well as Billy's demons. Yeah, it was hard to find myself after I finished doing that play. And to just connect the two, Lady Day, which is written by a man named Stephen Stahl, and Eleanor Fagan, was originally to be part of a double CD in a production of Lady Day that I was trying to get up in New York City. And it looked like it had a home in a regional theater outside of Boston, and then we were going to take it to Broadway, and I had funds but not enough, and then the person that was going to subsidize, you know, the rest of the monies pulled out. But while we were talking and I was making arrangements for everything, I decided that for the Broadway show release that I was going to do, okay, I was thinking large, I wanted to sell this double CD as a cast album where I did half of the material from the play in the style of the play, which takes place in the early 1950s, and the other half a more contemporary take on the Billie Holiday songs. And so I went into the studio, and we recorded Eleanor Fagan in 3 days.
Wow.
And I mixed it in a day, and then I just put it up until, you know, I thought we were going to be doing the show. And so then when I didn't do the show, I had this CD. So I didn't want to put it out as a commercial release because I didn't want to get this stigma attached to me again of being the jazz singer doing all the tribute albums. But I didn't have an album because I'd been spending so much time working on that project. So Universal asked if they could hear it, and they were going to get involved in the play if I could, you know, get it to Broadway. Then they were going to give me the money for Broadway, but they didn't want to give me any money for the initial run. So I sent them the tracks to listen to. They flipped out, and they said, you've got to release this. And then we had about 2 weeks where I was like, I can't. I've just come down off of Red Earth.
Ah, okay. Wow.
I've been in Africa for the last year.
Wow.
And to go back and do standards, even though they're songs that, you know, associated with Billy and Billy's own songs, I was just not a happy camper at the thought of, after having had this amazing musical experience, this eye-opening, ear-opening experience of these polyrhythms and this West African music and the beats combined with the jazz, and, you know, it was so rich. It was just so rich. To come back and find myself with a trio or a quartet, I was just like, this is not my idea of having fun. I finally agreed to release it, and I'm glad I did. I'm really glad I did, because she walked me to the podium, Billie Holiday. I've been walked to the Grammy podium by Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday.
See, How can I go on without you? Well, you took the part that once was my heart. Oh, baby, I think I love me.
I should probably use this opportunity to give you the phone number, 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, ticket giveaway. Yes, Dee Dee Bridgewater is going to be at the Blue Note from the 16th through the 21st. And if you dial, let's see, the shows are for, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. That's it. So 212-209-2900. Oh, look at the lines now. 212-209-2900. Back to Dee Dee.
You took the part that once was my heart.
There's one thing I do have to talk to you about, because you can't be on WBAI/Pacifica Radio without our talking about the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization.
Yeah, FAO.
Yes.
I've been involved with the FAO since 1999. I was one of the first four goodwill ambassadors nominated by the FAO to help promote their cooperative world hunger program,
mm-hmm.
which is a fabulous program, and that basically is all I'm supposed to do. To better understand how this cooperative program worked, I asked the general director, who's stepping down this year after 20-something years. His name is Dr. Jacques Diouf, and he's from Senegal. I accompanied him on, they call it a mission to Senegal, to visit some 22 cooperatives that they had started in villages around Dakar, just to see how these cooperatives were working. And the way that they work is a village will make a request for sponsorship by the FAO, and the FAO will visit, and if they decide that they will sponsor the village, whatever that village does to sustain themselves, the FAO tries to help them to learn better methods of sustaining themselves. So it's a program that helps villagers to become totally self-sufficient.
And you have a direct link to the FAO.org spot at ddbridgewater.com, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I think I've always been a person that has always been concerned about other people
mm-hmm.
and human rights.
So one of the things that I want to sort of wrap up with...
Okay, my darling.
...is... you're being at the Blue Note.
Yes.
You're going to be there starting Tuesday, August 16th,
mm-hmm.
through Sunday, August 21st.
Yes.
And it's a tribute to Ray Brown.
Yes.
And I understand you're going to be with Christian McBride. We love Christian McBride here.
We love Christian. He's my baby. My big teddy bear. He can play that bass.
Yes, he can. And he has a wonderful radio voice.
Yes.
So if you ever need anybody to sit in for you on...
Oh, he has already.
He has? Oh, I missed that.
Oh, yeah.
Sit in for you on Jazz Set, NPR's Jazz Set.
Thanks.
Which is still airing.
It's 20 years old. I've been doing it 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Ranford did it for 10 years.
Right. So look forward to seeing you in New York.
Oh, that's going to be wonderful. We honored Ray. It was tremendous. I mean, lines were, I mean, they had to pull out the red rope and put it out. And, I mean, you would have thought it was a rock and roll concert going on in the Blue Note. You know, and we were rambunctious on the stage because I just love them young men.
Do you know who else is going to be with you?
Benny Green on piano and Greg Hutchinson on drums.
Excellent.
Yeah, because we are all Ray Brown alumni.
Okay.
Mr. Brown, he said, you want to ride my horsey, little girl? He would be carting his bass case through the airport. Those Dapper Dan musicians, honey. Mm. The musicians from Ray Brown's era were so classy.
Mm.
And they could get away with murder. We were singing at the Blue Note one night. I was with Ray Brown. And I don't know what happened. But I'm singing, and he's right behind me because he likes to set his group up really tight. So I just had enough space to sing in front of Ray. And I'm singing, and he says, little girl, if I put a $500 bill on the floor, will you bend over and pick it up?
No.
I was in the middle of singing a ballad.
Oh, no.
And in the middle of the ballad, I went, ah, Ray, stop. He's like, dang, Bridge, I didn't mean for you to share it with the public. I was just asking you, would you bend over and pick it up? And I was like, I can't sing with you talking at me. Oh, we were awful. Oh, so, and Christian saw stuff, so, you know, Christian then did his take on all this stuff. Oh, my Lord. It was terrible. It's terrible. So we will probably have a great time.
Excellent. Oh,
and he just sent
that.
Me a text, Christian. This morning, he says, are you ready for some good loving on the stage? Some kissing and hugging and good loving? I was like, oh, Lord, it's going to happen again. You know, I'm too old for these young men to be messing with me. I get flustered. I get excited. I think, oh, maybe there's a chance. Ah!
Well, we've been having a great time talking to Dee Dee Bridgewater. Well, thank you very much, Dee Dee Bridgewater, for joining Sugar and My Bowl. And I really enjoyed this discussion.
Well, thank you, Joyce Jones, for having me on your show. And I hope I was some good sugar in your bowl.
Most definitely.
And I'm going to make you the coffee in my cup. And I hope that we will have another opportunity.
Well, I'll definitely see you at the Blue Note. Everybody, www.bluenote.net if you aren't lucky to get tickets tonight.
Oh, thanks, Joyce.
Thank you, Dee.
Okay.
Whether you're from the man of my heart, I'll string along. You need me so.
we need to get up out of here. It's like, gosh, I was like answering the phone, getting tickets. Unfortunately, they're all gone. All pairs gone. Sorry, people. But it's good to know that there are all these people listening. And hopefully you pledged during the drive. And thank you for those who did. Oh, gosh. La Nueva Alternativa. Are you Bonafide? Is that who you are? No, you look like somebody named Bonafide. Anyway. anyway. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Joyce Jones. And I will be back. When will I be back? Gosh, let me look at my calendar. Wow, I don't know. I think I'll be back in September. It's hard to tell, you know, with the fun drives and things that happen. But stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. And next week, if you were expecting Dwight Brewster this week, the world of jazz will be back next week on the 21st. So let's get out of here. This is WBAI, once again, in New York, 99.5 FM.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.